Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know all that data we have up on Facebook and Google and all over the internet that gets used by advertisers? It turns out when you break it down, we're not worth all that much. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 23rd of February. And there are broadly defined two ways to think about the online privacy recommendations the White House released today. What it means for us, where our data goes, and what it means for companies, as in where the money is in our data. Guess which one we chose? Yes, we chose the second option, and we've got analyst Fatima Kadablu on the phone to walk me through it. Fatima, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
All right, so listen, not to make this all about me, but let's make this all about me. How much is all this data that the White House is talking about, how much is my personal data worth to anybody? I mean, how much would they pay?
You know, I did a little bit of research on you, and I went and I decided to see what it would cost me to target Kai and folks like you on Facebook. So if I was a marketer running an ad on Facebook right now looking for 48-year-old males living in L.A.
Hey, now, don't
like
tell anybody
craft
that.
Beer.
48? Holy cow. All right. All right.
I did my research.
Yep.
I'd find like 34,000 people.
Wow.
Not a ton. But for each of those people, if every single one of them clicked on my ad, I'd pay about $1.50. So in aggregate, $34,000 for a marketer to run an ad like that if every single person clicked.
Right.
It's not chump change. But as an individual, it's not very much money.
My stuff is worth like a nickel.
It's a buck.
It's a buck.
Right? I mean, at the end of the day, you're worth a buck.
Flip it around for me, though, because you have to figure that the more searches I do, the more exposed I am, the more categories into which I fit. So not only is it 48-year-old male living in L.A. who likes beer, but let's say I start searching on, I don't know, fly fishing and 1964 and a half Mustangs.
Oh, yeah. You got some really interesting interests there.
I made those last two up. But you see my point, right?
I do. And the reality is there are very few marketers who are actually interested in exactly who you are. They're interested in lifestyle. They're interested in what you might look like as a set of attributes, as a demographic.
So what does it mean then if Google and all these companies are so willing to put this do not track or do not follow button on the web browser? What are they giving up?
Well, they've certainly not given up. What it means is that consumers are much more aware, and consumers will start to pull back on how they behave online if they feel that they're not being respected and their privacy and their data is not being respected. That's the crux of this. What we really need to do as an industry, as marketers, as businesses, is start educating consumers and help them understand how we really use their data. Be transparent about the information that we're sharing and that we're capturing about them. That's really what this comes down to. And I think Do Not Track is a great first step forward for that.
You know what I want, though? I want that transparency, but I also want a cut because I am the product.
Yeah. The reality, again, of this situation is how do you keep track of those bits and bytes, number one, and how do you attribute them back to any individual? When we talk about privacy and we talk about things like Do Not Track and cookies, those cookies are not attributable to an individual person. Mm-hmm. There's nobody tying that information back to Fatima Kadablu or Kai Rizdahl. So how do we decide who gets paid for it? That's a really difficult number to come up with, a really difficult calculation to do.
Fatima Kadablu is a senior analyst at Forrester Research. Fatima, thanks so much for playing along, I guess.
Thanks for having me, Kai. Have a good day.
I am having a pretty good day, as it turns out. So too did traders on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's tempting to set up a story on digital technology by quoting Scott McNeely, one of the guys who co-founded Sun Microsystems. "You have no privacy," he once said. "Get over it." All the more appropriate, perhaps, given today's news. And to some extent, you can see how that might be true with web surfing and tracking your cell phone. But the music you listen to? One of the fastest growing music labels out there is a barely known company called X5 Music Group. It releases no new music. Almost all its sales are digital. And yet last year, it was the number two digital classical music label in the country. And they got there by studying what consumers want to buy from the moment they start searching for it. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins has the story.
You might think people looking for this search for this. Beethoven's Fifth Symphony in C minor.
No.
That's Scott Ambrose Riley, CEO of X5 North America, one of the biggest music companies you may have never heard of. He says most people looking for this search for this, classical music. Knowing how average people search for music, especially classical music, has helped X5 sales grow 70% a year for several years. It brought in more than $10 million in revenue last year in mostly online sales.
We don't think we've sold many classical albums to people who would call themselves classical aficionados. We think we've made it easy for people who wanted some classical for their playlists to find something quality.
Here's how. X5 scours Google and other search engines and studies online marketplaces like iTunes and Amazon. Ross Malaga teaches the science of search engines at New Jersey's Montclair State University. He says X5 is hunting for popular keywords.
They can see what people are already searching for online.
Then the company, which licenses dozens of back catalogs, creates compilation albums tailored to the most prominent searches. Classical music for meditation and yoga. There's also the most essential classical music for your baby, and of course, classical music for hipsters. Most albums sell for less than $10. Keith Hatchek directs the music management program at the University of the Pacific. He says X5, as well as smaller labels like Razor and Tie and Rostrum, represent a fundamentally different business model in music.
You build the audience first. You don't create the product and then try and create demand.
What you're seeing is kind of a new kind of retailer.
Steven Rosenbaum is the author of Curation Nation.
That doesn't, you know, have goods and services on a shelf, but simply has the ability to look at the noisy big world of things and say, here's 10 things you should see today.
Rosenbaum says lots of entrepreneurs are using crowdsourcing sites like Kickstarter and Quirky to figure out the types of products people want before those products are created.
X5 is a canary in a coal mine, and you're going to see more and more consumer goods built after a trend evolves that wants them.
X5 Scott Ambrose Riley says to cash in on those trends, the company needs to win the search.
You want to make sure the genre of the album you're trying to push is in the title.
That may sound obvious, but think of how many classical albums don't say classical in the title. So yeah, X5's titles can be pretty boring. Its most successful release so far?
The 50 Most Essential Pieces of Classical Music.
That title has sold more than 200,000 albums, and it's been in the iTunes Top 10 Classical for over 3 years. But if it fell out of favor, it would simply disappear, and something else would take its place. X5 releases as many as 400 albums a month, and there's always another mix to be made. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
We've talked before on the program about all the computers that do battle in the stock market every day, chasing fractions of a penny differences in share prices. High-frequency trading, it's known as. And it now accounts for as much as half of all the shares that change hands in the U.S. stock market on any given day. And that has regulators worried it might also be creating wild market swings, an uneven playing field, and the potential for price manipulation. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Here's how fast you can buy a stock and then turn right around and unload it these days. High-frequency firms can make thousands of trades in a snap. They blanket the market with pending orders so they can jump on split-penny price differences with lightning speed. But by one estimate, they cancel up to 97% of those buy-and-sell orders. Federal regulators worry that's creating arbitrary price swings, so they might start making high-frequency traders pay fees for all their canceled trades. At the Tab Group, though, market researcher Larry Tab argues that high-frequency trading doesn't necessarily skew stock prices over time.
You know, at the end of a one-minute, five-minute period, what they've bought, they've sold. So it really doesn't much impact the longer-term price of these stocks.
Adam Honore is a market researcher at Aite Group. He cautions that regulators could chase high-frequency traders away, and the loss of that business could make trading more expensive for everyone.
Remember back in the dot-com heyday when we were paying 20 and 30 bucks a trade, and now we're paying $7 a trade. I mean, where do you think that comes from? That's not magic. That's people supplying liquidity into the market and technology and innovation into the market.
Honore says regulators could better spend their time on other priorities. But former Senator Ted Kaufman, an outspoken critic of high-frequency trading, says this issue needs to be a priority.
The fact that we could have another financial meltdown like we had during the dot-com thing or we had during the financial crisis, there'll be nobody left in our market.
Kaufman says a level playing field is essential to restoring faith in the market. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
BP and some of the other companies involved in the Deepwater Horizon oil spill 2 years ago now are about to go on trial. On Monday, a judge in New Orleans is going to hear claims for damages and civil penalties brought by an exhaustive list of plaintiffs in the case. That includes the feds, the state of Louisiana, and more than 100,000 others. So it won't surprise you a bit to hear BP would like nothing better than to avoid what some are already calling the trial of the century. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports.
BP won't talk details, but it's pretty clear the company would much rather settle out of court. Energy consultant Stephen Kopitz.
If you go to court, then you're at the roulette table, and that may turn out to be more favorable or less favorable. But it's absolutely certain it's going to continue to bleed BP's reputation.
Not to mention its bottom line. David Ullman used to prosecute environmental crimes for the Justice Department. He says BP is worried the judge might find them grossly negligent in the disaster.
Their potential liability for civil penalties alone goes up by $13 billion if they're found grossly negligent. That is too big a risk for any company to take going into a trial.
Especially since that finding would bolster any criminal charges that have yet to be filed. Some legal experts expect a settlement after the trial's begun, once BP gets a better feel for how the judge might rule. And once the company settles, says Jacqueline Savitz at the environmental group Oceana, it can tell shareholders,
we're done, we're moving forward, we're putting this behind us. And that would be a positive thing. But from the perspective of the American people, whether we would be made whole, whether our resources would be replaced, is really another question.
The investment bank Morgan Stanley has speculated BP would settle the case for $20 to $25 billion. That's slightly less than the profits BP made last year. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I don't remember ever talking about money with my friends. It seemed like we could have it all.
Days of high school passed. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 46 points today, about a third of 1%, wrapped up at 12,984. The NASDAQ gained 23 points, 0.8%, 2956 the number. The S&P 500 put on 5 points, 0.4%, ended at 1363. Retailers came in today with some not-so-good sales figures. Safeway rolled down 7.5%. Kohl's department stores took off 6% today. Sears Holding Company racked up an 18% gain, though, after announcing plans to sell off 11 store sites to raise cash. We did a story once on how Sears is really a real estate company, not a retail company. Look it up. It's on the website. Meanwhile, Hewlett-Packard deleted 6% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note edged down to 1.99%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I don't know if at this point in the global business cycle, the phrase mild recession is going to calm anybody's economic nerves, but that's the way the European Union sees 2012 shaping up on the continent. Shrinking economic growth overall, in part because of the various debt crises we all know and love so well. Commentator Angelo Tarukas is first-generation Greek-Canadian, and he says, yeah, Greece has its debts, but payback? Oh, you know what that's like.
Everywhere I go lately, everyone keeps asking me about Greece. What's going on with Greece? They owe billions of dollars. They're not paying their debts. What's wrong with you Greeks? Whoa, stop right there. Let's talk about something that the Greeks haven't brought up. Yeah, residuals and royalties for what the Greeks have given the world. And you're asking me, what have the Greeks given the world? Okay, let's start with the English dictionary. Something like 80,000 words in the English dictionary are Greek-based. Without Greek, there wouldn't even be the words economy or money. Yeah, look it up. Of course, Greeks also give us words like crisis and chaos, but whatever. That doesn't matter. And you know, you couldn't even get sick without Greek. I'm talking about all the medical terms. Yeah, laryngitis, dermatitis, nausea, you know, herpes. Well, that was Hermes' brother, but, you know, he fooled around a lot. The way I figure it, all those words have to be worth like $1 million a pop. So we're talking $80 billion here. Let's see, what else did the Greeks give us? Oh, democracy. You know, I mean, it needs a few upgrades now and then, but democracy's got to be worth $200 billion. I mean, come on. It's your right to vote we're talking about here. And we'll even throw in Plato and Socrates and Aristophanes and all those other guys that just kept blabbing on forever and ever. Okay, what else? Oh, yeah. And let's not forget the Olympics. Yeah, you know, shot put, javelin, 4x100 relay, all that kind of stuff. That's worth flat rate bargain, $250 billion. Not to mention marathon. That's right. Whenever all you skinny and shaped people get up early in the morning and start running around for 26.2 miles, that came from Greece. I mean, the guy died in the end, but that's irregardless. We'll throw that in with the Olympic package. Greece should get its royalties and residuals back. The way I tallied it up, Greece is due $530 billion. We owe what? $430 billion. So there's a surplus net to the Greeks of $100 billion. Why don't we call it square? Right there. Yeah, that's good. You guys keep it as a tip. Thank you. You can thank the Greeks for that and the world, too.
Angelo Tarukas is a Greek-Canadian comedian living, as it happens, here in Los Angeles. Your thoughts? Send them if you got them. Marketplace.org is the website. We've reached, for now at least, the end of the long and winding Republican primary debate trail. Last night's session in Phoenix was the last one on the schedule, so by now, everybody's got a pretty good handle on what they're looking for in a candidate, right? And the candidates know what voters are looking for, too. Yeah, if only.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said...
Attitude Check is what we call our partnership with Gallup. Frank Newport, the editor-in-chief, is with us every week to help us understand what Americans are really thinking. Frank, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to be with you.
So about these debates last night, it was interesting, to say the least, to watch what could be the last debate. And it was interesting also to watch Rick Santorum. He's the guy who's been in the lead. He's won a bunch of states in the past couple of three, 4 weeks. And I wanted to ask about his approach. His approach has been restoring our moral values. He's very plain spoken about that. What do we know about what voters think when they listen to Rick Santorum talk?
Well, that's not a great approach. In fact, to get at it, we simply ask people, would you rather see a candidate that you are confident can fix the economy, even though you disagree on moral issues, or do you want one that you agree with on moral issues, even if you're not confident that he could fix the economy? And guess what? 2-to-1 margin. People say, we want somebody who can fix the economy. And that's true, actually, Kai, even among Republicans. So Santorum would be well advised, based on these data, to get off the social issues and to really focus, particularly if he wants to be in the general election, on what's the number one issue. And, of course, that is fixing the economy.
Well, you parse the data for a second, though, for me, Frank, and talk to me about religious voters in the Republican base.
Well, clearly that's Santorum's key constituency. Our data show he does much better among Republicans who attend church weekly than any other group. He really trumps Mitt Romney among that group. But even when we look at that group of Republicans who are the most consistent churchgoers, the most religious, we still find, although the gap's lowered some, they would still rather have a candidate that can fix the economy rather than one that they agree with on moral issues.
Let me take a turn here to a candidate who is also worried about the economy, has the advantage of incumbency, the president, and something that could wind up hitting him, gas prices. What are you paying for gas?
We pay in New Jersey, of course, if you have to get premium, it's higher, but $3.80.
I think
you get
okay.
regular for down to $3.50, $3.40, a lot lower than out there in California, clearly.
Yeah, I saw $4.27 on the way in this morning. And my question to you is, what do we know about gas prices and presidential elections?
We don't really see a high correlation between a president's approval rating and gas prices. And, of course, a president's approval rating is the best predictor of reelection. Take Obama right now. Mm-hmm. Gas prices have been going up, as you and I just talked about, and yet his approval rating is steady as it goes, right there in the mid-40s. We don't see any hit on that. Our last time, Kai, that we asked what's the most important problem facing the country, 1% mentioned gas prices. Back in 2008, we had 25% or so who had mentioned gas prices
really?
When gas went up then.
Wow.
So far... our conclusion is we're not seeing a big hit yet on Obama or on anything else of the gas prices. But, of course, we'll wait and see what happens.
Yeah, things change. Because when it's $4.50, right, then somebody's going to be paying a political price.
There's a ratchet effect, I think,
right.
Which means that if the prices are where we've seen them before, then we don't worry as much. But when it gets to $4.50,
right.
or, you know, we heard dire predictions of $5 a gallon, then all of a sudden, clearly, it would have an impact.
Yeah. Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief of Gallup. The partnership that we do with them every week on the broadcast is called Attitude Check. You can check our website for more on the data that Gallup comes up with. Frank, we'll see you next week.
My pleasure.
It was one of the closest elections in modern history. There were allegations of impropriety, ballot box stuffing. A candidate was disqualified, even. I'm talking, of course, about the student council race at Carver High School, as depicted in the minor cult classic movie Election, starring Reese Witherspoon, directed by Alexander Payne. We've been looking at places made famous by movies this week to get a sense of how people in those places are feeling about what they'd hoped for when they were younger and what they expected would happen in life. Election was filmed just outside of Omaha, Nebraska, where Alexander Payne grew up. From Papillion, Nebraska, here's Marketplace's David Gura.
Tracy Flick is ambitious. She's a high school junior hell-bent on becoming student council president. She's cloying and competitive, and she's convinced she'll win.
Some people say I'm an overachiever, but I think they're just jealous. My mom always tells me I'm different, you know, special. And if you look at all the things I've accomplished so far, I think you'd have to agree.
For her, the election is a means to an end, her ticket out of small-town Nebraska. Election came out in 1999. Back then, the economy was booming. President Clinton had vanquished his Republican rivals. The tech bubble hadn't burst. There was the sense that the country was moving fast in the right direction. Nebraskan Adrian Whitsett could have gone to school with Tracy Flick.
I don't remember ever talking about money with my friends. It seemed like we could have it all.
Whitsett was in the class of 1999 at Papillion La Vista Senior High. That's where Alexander Payne filmed Election. There is no Carver High School here. Now Whitsett is part of the news team at ABC's Omaha affiliate. Today, Papillion La Vista is almost unrecognizable from the school in the movie. The trophy cases sparkle, there's a big auditorium, two gyms, an indoor pool. Whitsett says the movie Election doesn't have many fans here.
The feeling was the school itself, Papillion La Vista and the school administration, was not happy. They were very, very upset with what had happened in this movie. And if you see it, you might understand why.
It's a movie about adultery and divorce. Teachers' lives are ruined. And if you've never been to Papillion, Nebraska, you'd think the local landmarks are motels and pizza restaurants. Josh Reeves also graduated in 1999. He owns two small businesses.
It kind of made our town look dingy and gross, actually. I understand that's why they picked our school, because the idea behind the movie was to keep that kind of dark feel.
Election didn't do well in theaters. It became a hit on video and DVD. And maybe that's because it was too dark for 1999. Today, though, it seems ahead of its time. The movie came out a year before Bush v. Gore. Then the tech bubble burst, then came 9/11, the housing crisis. Josh Reeves met his wife Stephanie in high school. She's a recruiter. And Stephanie says what did ring true to her at the time was Tracy Flick's determination to leave Nebraska.
When we moved away, I didn't know if we would ever come back. Probably wasn't thinking that I was going to come back.
They got jobs in Arizona. They bought a place there. But a funny thing happened to them and to a lot of their classmates.
You have a family and you're in a really large city compared to where you grew up. And you just kind of start to miss that small town feeling.
Didn't hurt that while Nebraska missed out on some of the economic highs of the last decade, it also skated through the lows. Today, unemployment is just over 4% here. So the Reeves family moved back to Papillion. Classmate Brian Mead had his sights set on D.C. He dreamed about becoming a spy.
I would say that I hope to see the world. But ironically, I wouldn't say that I hope to get out of Omaha.
After college, he moved east, but now Mead and his family live just a few miles from where he grew up. Today, he's a tax attorney. What happened to the Papillion-La Vista class of 1999 is part of a bigger trend. Demographer Bill Fry says that in the early 2000s, the lights of big cities burned pretty bright. Midwesterners moved to the Sun Belt, to the coasts, but then...
There was a mortgage meltdown, and on top of that, there was a lack of jobs. All of this kind of came bang, 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 bang between the end of 2007 through 2008 through the end of the decade.
And many of them moved back. At the end of election, Tracy Flick winds up in Washington. We see her climbing into a limo. We can only wonder what's next for her, where she's headed. If she's anything like her real-life classmates, it just might be back home. In Papillion, Nebraska, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, and I don't know if maybe President Obama hasn't read the Gallup research on politics and rising gas prices this year and how they seem to be no big deal so far, but there the president was today at the University of Miami making a big speech. About what? Yeah, rising gas prices. Crude closed at $107 a barrel in New York today. That's up a buck and a half. And that's it for us. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow gained 46 points, about a third of 1%. The NASDAQ up 23 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 put on 5 points, 0.4%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.